coming Sabbath, the beginning of a new series, by the way, on justification by faith. And we'll be studying on that subject for several weeks. There is a credibility gap concerning justification by faith. Almost everybody thinks he understands it, and almost nobody does, according to the spirit of prophecy, if I understand it correctly. And so we want to be dealing with these difficulties we have in understanding this most important subject of Christ our righteousness, justification by faith. And each week is dedicated to some aspect where we seem to have a clash in our own minds that prohibits a correct understanding of the topic. So we're trying to deal with all the hindrances, all the barriers, all the difficulties with communicating about this very important topic. We hope you take advantage of hearing every one if you possibly can. Tonight we're studying the chapter on diet and health on page 295 of Ministry of Healing. And this is a beginning now of a series on diet. You've already had one study on it, I understand. And we want to go back and start taking some of these principles into consideration. I wish you'd look at this chapter differently than we usually do. Suppose you're a physician or a nurse trying to diagnose a case, and you're using heavenly understanding rather than medical school understanding, if that's permissible in Loma Linda, that God by inspiration has told us the cause of disease that men have not yet discovered. Do you believe that? And that perhaps men will never discover. Do you believe that? They will never become wise enough to understand what God has told us about cause of disease. That no matter how wise science gets and all the knowledge is increasing in science, they'll never discover some of the cause of disease that God has already told us about. And unfortunately, we as Adventists will go along and never discover them either. We won't believe that God knows more than medical science. And so we're not open to those things. And I wish you studied rather than from prohibitions that God is restricting our diets and so on and so forth, that from looking at a cause of disease and a cause of health. And also that sin has robbed us of what God gave us. We had a different kind of health in the days of Adam than we have now, did we not? When they lived to be nearly 1,000 years of age, don't you think they had a little bit different health than you have and I have? We hope we live to be 70. They never thought about 70 as being hardly out of the cradle, you know? You're just in preschool when you're 70, isn't that right? In mentality, too, by the way, and not just in physical development and other things like that. And so we have lost some things in health that God gave us. And our ideas about health and diet are perverted as a result of sin. And God says, now I want to undo all the bad things that sin has brought. And I want to get you back to the original health that I planned for man. Will you listen for a little while now, God says. May I tell you about the beginning, 6,000 years ago, and how it used to be in the good old days. So instead of taking his prohibitions and restrictions, what have we lost that God gave us? And what would we like to give us back? I think you get away from some of the no-nos we've studied in the past. It'll help you greatly. So we'll have two or three studies now on diet from week to week. Now, she begins with a text there, and she doesn't give a text. Just below on my old Ministry of Healing, it's taken from Ecclesiastes 10:17, if you have your Bibles. And it reads like this, and she just takes an excerpt from it. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles, and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. She leaves out about princes, and she says, eat for strength and not for drunkenness. When the Bible talks about eating and drinking with the drunken, it doesn't mean those intoxicated with liquor only. It means those intoxicated with food. And there is food drunkenness or food intoxication. And we have many people coming to church drunk on Sabbath. Hundreds and thousands of them. We have them going to bed on Sabbath intoxicated. And every other day of the week too. We wonder why our brains don't work better when we're drunken with food. And she talks about this in various places. So now eat for not for drunkenness, but for strength. Now drunkenness is a form of just satisfying appetites, you know, tastes. And we keep satisfying and satisfying and satisfying and satisfying like an alcoholic when we're a foodaholic. And so let's remember some of these things as we go along. Now first of all, she describes what the reason is for being very selective about the food you eat. It's in the very first paragraph, and she usually starts out with general principles. And remember, these general principles are deep, and you have to think a little bit. Don't just take the obvious superficial meaning you find there. You'll miss something. Our bodies are built up from the food we eat, and far more than scientists teach. They're built up from the food we eat, our bodies. There is a constant breaking down of the tissues of the body. Every movement of every organ involves waste.
And this waste is repaired from our food. There's a wasting away and a replacement. It's replaced with our food, you see. Each organ of the body requires its share of nutrition. The brain must be supplied with its portion. The bones, muscles, and nerves demand theirs. It is a wonderful process that transforms the food into blood and uses this blood to build up the varied parts of the body. But this process is going on continually, supplying with life and strength each nerve, muscle, and tissue. Now, in that very concise paragraph, she's describing this magnificent miracle that takes place in our bodies, moment by moment, hour by hour, day by day, year by year, our whole lifetime. Everyone's sitting here, isn't that right? Goes on and on and on and on. And this week's Sabbath School lesson is talking about how magnificently our bodies are made. Read the opening quotation, the Sabbath School lesson from Medical Ministry, and read it 20 times. For when you read that many times, you're just beginning to understand it. And read the whole page if you have the book. It's a marvelous thing there. So this is the reason why your body is made up of what you eat. When you're born, it's made of what your mother ate. But soon you replace that tissue, see, and it's made of what you eat. So you're deciding what you're going to be like the rest of your life by what you eat day by day. If you get looking too old, too fast, it's not what you put on the outside, it's what you put on the inside, right? You might be eating wrong. That's why you look so old. That's why you feel so weak. And she describes weakness in this chapter, doesn't she? Very definitely. And many people come to doctors nowadays saying, I'm always so weak and so tired. Read about weakness and tiredness in this chapter. It's right in there. Just many, many things for a diagnostician to figure out about some of these complaints we chronically have, many of us. Now, this chapter is unique, this book, for here there are general principles. I want you to notice the title headings of the different parts of the chapter. The first one is on, beginning on page 295, is on selection of foods. What selection do you make? The second one is on variety. The third one is on preparation of foods. The fourth one on regularity in eating. The next one on wrong conditions of eating. Then on overeating. Then on even Sabbath in your diet. Then reform in diet. So now here are all these different areas of very general principles about eating habits, food and so forth, what to eat and what not to eat. All described here in quite general principles for us to understand. Now I want you to remember that these general principles are given a chapter preceding the one on flesh foods. Adventists invariably get the cart before the horse. We understand about flesh foods and nothing about general principles of eating. In fact, very few people ever really studied this chapter in depth, but they can tell you quite a bit about vegetarianism. She put vegetarianism after this chapter. She established, first of all, general principles for all of diet, then went into details about that. So not until you understand this chapter are you well equipped to understand the next chapter on flesh foods and other chapters concerning food and diet. We must come back and get this very basic chapter first. So let's try to understand what God has given us in this. Now this selection of foods is a very interesting one, and everybody likes a good selection, don't you? And she talks about why we ought to be selective in our foods. Right there on page 295, the first quotation under the idea of selection of foods. She discusses this. Those foods should be chosen that best supply the elements needed for building up the body. So she wants to use good scientific sense. Very good judgment now. Food should be chosen that best supply the elements needed for building up the body. In this choice, appetite is not a safe guide. It's not what you like, it's what you need, right? Appetite is what you think you like, you know. But that's not what the body needs. Let your mind be better advised than just what your tongue tells you or your taste buds or your stomach. Now, use better judgment than your tongue has. If your brain is in your tongue, then follow your tongue. If your brain is up above there, then follow what's up above. Right? Some people use a tongue for a brain, and it's always sticking out. So we ought to use better judgment, she says. In this choice, appetite is not a safe guide. Through wrong habits of eating, the appetite has become perverted. So our tongues are not safe guide, you see. Often it demands food that impairs health and causes weakness instead of strength. We cannot safely be guided by the customs of society. First of all, your appetite is not a safe guide. Second of all, customs of society not safe. The disease and suffering that everywhere prevail are largely due to popular errors in regard to diet. But that's a sweeping statement. Disease and suffering that everywhere prevail are largely due to popular errors in regard to diet. So doctors, the highest percentage of patients coming to you ill are ill because of popular errors in regard to diet. How many ask them questions about their diet? Nurses, when you check with patients, how many are concerned about their diet? Well, if they're diabetic, you say, if they're overweight or something. That's not what she's talking about. They're largely due. The patients coming to you with disease, you see, and suffering that everywhere prevail are largely due to popular errors in regard to diet. We must learn how to diagnose cases, first of all, from diet. Right? If the highest percentage is due to errors in diet, the first thing you ought to ask questions about is diet. What do you eat? When do you eat? What do you eat? How often do you eat? Isn't that right? What kind of food do you eat? All sorts of things. That's where we ought to start. If you don't start there, you're not a believer in the spirit of prophecy. Right? Burn up the red books. Stop being a hypocrite. Stop pretending we believe what we don't believe. I mean that, honestly. We profess that these books are our guide, and nobody believes them anymore. Who diagnosed the case according to the red books? If you say they think I was a fanatic, I might lose my credentials to practice. Maybe that'd be the best thing that could happen. Honestly. If science is wiser than God, then worship science. And I wonder if God doesn't think we do. And science and God do not always agree, because medical science is not saying that most of disease is due to errors in diet. Are they saying that? At least we're not following that if they're saying that. So sometime or other we must come back to the place where we begin to diagnose disease as a consequence of this, you see. That's what she says. Popular errors in regard to diet. So whatever society teaches, whatever your appetite tells you, these are not safe standards for eating. And they never have been, by the way. They're not safe standards. We must do something else if we're to find the truth about this. Now, even under these circumstances, we must be careful. She said, in order to know what are the best foods, the bottom page 295, what are the best foods, we must study God's original plan for man's diet. In other words, God invented this machinery that we call our human body. He planned a diet for it. To know what's best, we must accept what he planned for it. He created all the food that men eat. So he must have known which is best, you see. He goes on and describes it. He who created man and understands his needs appointed Adam his food. Behold, he said, I have given you every herb yielding seed. An herb is a plant, is it not? I give you every plant yielding seed. And every tree in which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. So it's fruit from a tree that has seed in the fruit. That's the original diet. Every plant bearing seed, which would be all the grains, the lentils, the peas, the beans, all these are seeds. All those seeds that are good for food. Every fruit from a tree that has seed in it. Peaches, apples, pears, you know the rest of them, don't you? Many of them. Apricots, there's so many like that. So, which is the fruit of the tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for food. Upon leaving Eden to gain his livelihood by tilling the soil, the earth rather, under the curse of sin, man received permission to eat also the herb of the field. Now that's the plant itself. That was the second diet. She goes on and says, grains, fruits, nuts, and vegetables constitute the diet chosen for us by our Creator. These foods prepared in as simple and natural a manner as possible, those are qualifying, simple and natural manner as possible, are the most healthful and nourishing. They impart a strength, a power of endurance, and a vigor of intellect that are not afforded by a more complex and stimulating diet. It's time there were some Daniels around that said, try us out for 10 days and see if we're not wiser. It's really time. What does she say? And vigor of intellect that are not afforded by a more complex and stimulating diet. If you're having trouble with your grades, watch your diet. Is that what she says? It's exactly what she says. You're having trouble with your grades, watch your diet. Part of the reason for our stupidity in this age is that we eat wrongly. Part of the reason why we're so weak and so flabby and can't do very much is we eat wrongly. It affords strength and power of endurance and vigor of intellect. It's exactly what it says. Just bang, bang, bang. I'm getting weak. What are you eating? Isn't that right? What are you eating? How do you eat? Is that important to us? Now, these things God has given to us. Do you recognize that she was sticking God's neck out a long ways when she said this? God is defying medical science to prove that he's wrong. Right? All researchers everywhere, I challenge you, prove that I'm wrong, that's uninspired. I challenge you. Spend your millions to prove that God is wrong, that these books are not inspired. I challenge you to do it. You see, the world either laugh at Adventists because of our profession to believe in Ellen White, or they'll praise us, one or the other. Isn't that right? We either be a laughingstock or ridicule. You crazy Adventists believe in that woman, you know, and science has just proved her. Or you Adventists are well in advance of us 100 years because science has proven her. You know, it's time we really got on with this sort of thing. It really is. If we don't have Sunday laws, pretty soon national Sunday laws, great controversy is going to be burned by the thousands. Because for almost 100 years she's been predicting we're going to have national Sunday laws. And they'll come about by an amendment to the Constitution. So our necks are out a long ways, in case you didn't know it. They really are. And it's time we went back and studied these books. Do we really believe them? Has God talked to us, or, you know, is somebody just practicing a hoax upon us? If God has spoken to us, it's time we began to believe them as they really are, truths from the Lord. Now, in matters of diet, God invented the first diet. Man has never improved upon this at all. And we have much instruction about how to use those foods that He so magnificently provides for the use of every human being. And He's not asking you to suffer from lack of good food. No place will you find that. In fact, I'm coming to some very choice words about this. He wants you to enjoy your food more than you ever have before. Isn't that right? People who smoke say, you know, I like my smoking. I give up something I enjoy. Why do you rob me of good things? When they finally stopped and their taste buds returned to normal, they said, you know, I never knew what food tasted like before. Right? What good food tasted like before. I never have known. They've been robbed of so many good things by depraving their appetite, you see. And we can do this with improper use of foods. God wants us to have fullness of enjoyment of the things He's planned for our health. And He wants us to be happy about it as well as to be healthy. And good health makes us happy. Now, even under with a right food, there are qualifying circumstances and situations. So you must be very careful even about the right food. And she discusses that on page 296 and 7. But not all foods wholesome in themselves are equally suited to our needs under all circumstances. So even the things that God has given to us are not always suited to our needs under all circumstances. And she shows the qualifications for that, which are most unique there. Care should be taken in the selection of food. Our diet should be suited to the season. Winter or summer, you see, hot or cold. To the climate in which we live and to the occupation we follow. So the season, the climate, the occupation. Some foods that are adapted for the use of one season or in one climate are not suited to another. So there are different foods best suited for persons in different occupations. Often food that can be used with benefit by those engaged in hard physical labor is unsuitable for persons in sedentary pursuits or intense mental application. So the difference between you and the ditch digger if you're going to school over here, you know. And you can't eat the same foods routinely or you'll find yourselves becoming ill. The man out in the ditches can get by with it, some of the food, but you must eat a different diet when you're in, first of all, sedentary pursuits or intense mental application. And the combination of the two is extremely important to watch your diet then. And almost everybody in this town are engaged in sedentary habits and intense mental application, especially the students and faculty. Then we must change our diets radically. God has given us an ample variety of healthful foods, and each person should choose from it the things that experience and sound judgment prove to be the best suited to his own necessities. You'd be amazed if you worked a research project on yourself and experiment with your diet. And let somebody who understands this one paragraph do the research for you and just tell you what to eat and what not to eat. You'd be amazed what happened to your grades, the length of time it takes you to prepare your schoolwork, your memory, your ability to perform in your work. It would just change tremendously. But most of us feel that what we ate as children, you know, growing up where Mom cooked for us, and I have no criticism of Mom at all, but at that time you're extremely active, you know, just running and playing and heavy exercise, and suddenly you sit at a desk all day long and half the night. And you eat the same diet that Mom used to cook for you when you're extremely active. It won't work. As a child, you need the appetite of a ditch digger, you know, the food of a ditch digger diet. But as a student, you cannot. Some of us have been very active in physical labor and suddenly sit at a desk the rest of our lives. We must change just like the student changes. And suddenly we have problems, but because we're young and vigorous, the problems don't catch up until we're 40. Then we wonder what happened to us. We've been nibbling away at our health, you know, destroying it for 15, 20 years. And we wonder why it suddenly catches up. But you all discovered, if you haven't already, as most of us have past 40. Now, God wants you to have good health on and on and on. Just as a routine. There's no reason why we couldn't live much longer if we'd only take care of the food that, the diets that God has planned for us that make such a difference in our lives at present and also in the future. So we must take into consideration the season, the climate, and the activity in which we're engaged, and we'll be blessed more. Now, she discusses some of this selectivity of foods. She talks about, the bottom of page 297, about dried and canned fruit. She said, since we have good transportation and good modern facilities, we have some ways of preserving fruit for the wintertime. So you have fruit the year round, and she has high recommendations for fruit. And especially in California, with modern refrigeration now, it's very easy. The next thing she talks about is nuts and nut foods. They're on the top of page 298. And I wish you'd read about that. And she says, combined with grains and fruits and some roots to make foods that are healthful and nourishing. Nut foods are very good, you see. Care should be taken, however, not to use too large a proportion of nuts. Not too much quantity of them, so you're too large a percentage of a diet in that. Those who realize ill effects from the use of nut foods may find the difficulty removed by attending to this precaution. Not so much, you see, not such a percentage of it. It should remember, too, that some nuts are not so wholesome as others. Almonds are preferable to peanuts, but peanuts in limited quantities used in connection with grains are nourishing and digestible, but limited quantities. There's some here can tell you about kidney ash that's caused by certain kinds of nuts and eating too much of those. And you must be very careful about this. A variety is good, with limitation. But peanuts with limitations and used with grains, she said. You notice that? With grains are nourishing and digestible. Apparently the two together compensate each other and do something. You ought to do some research on that. When properly prepared, olives like nuts supply the place of butter and flesh meats. The oil is eaten in the olive is far preferable to animal oil or fat. So olive oil is much better than animal oils or fats of any kind. It serves as a laxative. Some need that. Its use will be found beneficial to consumptives and as healing to an inflamed, irritated stomach. Three ailments right there, which we have complaints. Olive oil will help in all three cases. We almost never use it and seldom prescribe it. I'm not talking about home remedies. I'm talking about inspired remedies, right? There's a vast difference. It's not something someone invented, a human being. It's something God has given to us, inspired remedies. So the use of nut foods and olive oil are given here in quite great detail. She goes on and says on page 298 and 9 that those who've had a wrong diet will have difficulty. It'll take time to get accustomed to a right diet. But she says their stomach will get accustomed and their taste buds and they'll like it. And they'll be more healthful, so be patient in doing this. The next general topic is variety. And as they say, the variety is the spice of life. And she has several just little tidbits all along the way here on page 299. I just want to jump to them, if I may. In order to maintain health, a sufficient supply of good nourishing food is needed. So must be enough. Adequate supply of food. That's very important. Starvation is not God's plan at all. Not even in fasting. The next paragraph, if we plan wisely, that which is most conducive to health can be secured in almost every land. So there's food every place, she said, we can use. And she mentioned all these grains, rice, wheat, corn, oats, are sent abroad everywhere. Also beans, peas, and lentils. If you put that with a native or imported fruits, she said you'll get a good diet without the use of flesh meats in almost every land in the world. So that's a good argument. The next thing she talks about, wherever fruit can be grown in abundance, a liberal supply should be prepared for winter. By canning or drying, of course, now freezing, we have that. Small fruits such as currants, gooseberries, strawberries, raspberries, and blackberries can be grown to advantage in many places where they are but little used and their cultivation is neglected. Many places in the Northland, they grow out in the woods, and you can just gather them by the bushels, literally. And they're easy to prepare and good in the wintertime. She talks there about canning and about the best kind of fruit. She said, it is especially necessary that the fruit for canning should be in good condition. Apparently, the canning conditions even today require that, as I understand it. Use little sugar in canning, little sugar, and cook the fruit only long enough to ensure its preservation. Thus prepared, it is an excellent substitute for fresh fruit. He even tells you how to can your food. Good fruit for canning, first of all. only and little sugar, and only cook it long enough to ensure its preservation. So be careful about overcooking fruit. She said, like this, it'll be a good substitute for fresh fruit. The next thing she talks about, dried fruits, and there are a large quantity of those, and uses a staple article for our diet. Use that the year round, she said, and it's good for health and vigor of all classes of workers, so both sedentary habits and those in physical labor is good for all of them. Then she has two tidbits at the bottom of the page, page 299. The first one, there should not be a great variety at any one meal, for this encourages overeating and causes indigestion. If you have a weight problem, one of the first places to start is how many items of food you put on the table. I've helped in weight control classes, and we never ask them, you know, how many varieties of food you have on the table. Ellen White mentions two or three at the most. Some have a half a dozen in one dish. Now, she's not talking about unsavory, unpalatable food. She's talking about tasty food that you just love to eat, you know. She never believed in having to eat food like medicine. She just never recommended that at all. And we must take health reform out of the medicinal area. It isn't medicine, you know. It's living, and it's joyful living, not abomination, as some people try to make it. God never planned for that. He made food tasty. And he wants us to eat tasty food. And there's much said about this in cooking. And so overeating is encouraged by too much variety of food. And it also causes indigestion. So you don't need more Tums. You need less variety of food, right? Less variety. That simple little thing, you know. It's so simple that we say, oh, well, you know, it's not too important. But by the time you put a whole group of little things together, you've got an enormous mountain of problems. So just a very few things at a table one time. It is not well to eat fruit and vegetables at the same meal. If the digestion is feeble, the use of both will often cause distress and inability to put forth mental effort. It is better to have the fruit at one meal and the vegetables at another. If you find yourself unable to think, maybe you should stop eating fruit and vegetables together. Is that what it says? Cause distress of the stomach and inability to put forth mental effort. You go to class or you come to a meeting and just can't think. What's wrong? What did you eat? What did you eat? And of course, there are scientific answers for this and reasons for it. So we ought to go back and look at some of these things. If you like to be intelligent and if you pride yourself in your intelligence, then watch what you eat. And we ought to start diagnosing more cases of indigestion by diet. What do we eat? Than we have done in the past. In addition, this says the meal should be varied. Now, why she said only two or three foods at one meal? The meal should be varied. And everyone listen to this, please. The same dishes prepared in the same way should not appear on the table meal after meal and day after day. In our home, we call that Mott's, more of the same. It's just something that started 20 years ago, I guess, in our family. What are we having for dinner? More Mott's, more of the same. The leftovers, in other words. She said we must not do that. Same dish prepared in the same way day should not appear on the table meal after meal and day after day. The meals are eaten with greater relish, and the system is better nourished when the food is varied. In other words, your taste buds, you know, begin to get alive, and the saliva flows when you see a variety. Isn't that right? What for dinner? Well, something different. What is it? You know, you can hardly wait to get there. When you especially can get the aroma seeping out there in the family room, the living room, you know, you can hardly wait for the table, and suddenly the wife is a good cook. Isn't that right? That's nice. Then you sit down and everything's fine. So be careful about more of the same. There should be variety. Not too much types of food, but variety from meal to meal. Then she has a long section on preparation of food. And all of you believe this, of course, but nobody puts it in words like this on page 300. It is wrong to eat merely to gratify the appetite. But no indifference should be manifest regarding the quality of the food or the manner of its preparation. It should be the finest in the world prepared, right? Good preparation. If the food eaten is not relished, the body will not be so well nourished. In other words, if you just don't love to put your teeth in that food, you won't get the value from it that you need. It will not be so well nourished. Isn't that interesting? When you sit down there, happy, you know, all the body alive, quickened, salivary glands, the stomach hardly can wait to see what this is going to taste like, you know, and you just lick your chops and taste it, you know, the food does you more good. Much more good. You who have to work on these shifts and you eat the meals, you know, on the fly, as so many of us have done for so many years. Be very careful. I know the pressures. I'm not critical. But even if it's a sandwich, you know, if you could just sit down there and take a long enough time to look at it so that you, you know, revive the taste buds. Get your mind distracted from all that rush, you know, of all the patients, whatever it is over there waiting for you, or the job or the pressures, and just sit down and savor that one sandwich, you know, until you eat it with relish. And it just goes down, you know, and it does something for you. No matter how simple, one apple, one orange, a banana, you know, anything. Eat it with relish. She talks about this. Don't you believe in that? That's marvelous, you know. It's terrible to eat food like medicine, or just don't even think what you're eating. Just stick it in, you know. You hardly are aware that you're eating. And many of us have done that for years in our hasty pace of life, you see. So the food should be carefully chosen and prepared with intelligence and skill. Then it's relished, you see. Then you like it. It's savory. And I believe she almost scolds people for preparing food that's not that way. And she's not trying to be a critic, but she's trying to be helpful to all of us. Now there's a long section on bread making and the use of bread. And I'm amazed that our institutions and our people and our homes and families who just don't believe a word of this. In fact, most of us don't believe much of this in our practice. Not every word of it. But she talks about superfine white flours, not the best for bread. But people have just had a diet of that all their lives and they refuse to change. It's more difficult to change their diet than almost anything in life, isn't it? Some people are frightened if you're going to change their diet. Its use is neither healthful nor economical. So you're losing money and you're losing health. Fine flour bread is lacking in nutritive elements to be found in bread made from the whole wheat. It is a frequent cause of constipation and other unhealthful conditions. Doctors, on every one of your diagnostic charts, do you eat white bread? Honestly, do you eat much pastries with white flour in it? It causes digestive problems, you see, and unhealthful conditions. Do you ask them this? They'll say, what do you want to know for? I want to know why you're sick. That's why I'm a doctor. That's what you pay me for, isn't that right? She talks about use of baking soda, baking powder and soda. And they're harmful and unnecessary. Cause inflammation of the stomach and poisons the entire system often. Do you ever ask people, how much this do you consume? How much this do you use in your home? You know, we never stop to think that we have things that are harmful to the body that we eat almost every day and sometimes three times a day. We just don't stop to think that's important, but it is important, and we need that out. And said, why is it they can make good bread with these things? But without, they cannot make without this, but that's an error, she said. It'd be more wholesome to the natural taste, be a better method, be more palatable if they left out those things. Now, in making of raised or yeast bread, milk should not be used in place of water. Don't use milk, use water, she said, in making bread. Why? The use of milk is an additional expense, and it makes the bread much less wholesome. You say, I put in bread, milk, and so they have more protein. It makes it less wholesome. Milk bread does not keep sweet so long after baking as does the bread made with water. And it ferments more readily in the stomach. Somebody ought to establish that. Somebody ought to do some research. See, that's what happens. She said, that's what happens. The Lord has told us that. Bread should be light and sweet. Not heavy, you see, and not some other bad flavors. Not the least taint of sourness should be tolerated. Not the least taint of sourness should be tolerated. The loaf should be small and so thoroughly baked that so far as possible the yeast germs shall be destroyed. That seems to be important, to destroy the yeast germs in the bread. When hot or new, raised bread of any kind is difficult of digestion. How many of you don't like hot bread? I didn't think so. Didn't see one hand. I didn't raise mine because I don't like it. But it's difficult of digestion. It should never appear on the table. Never. That's a strong word, yes. 301, middle of page. Yes, I'm coming to that. Now, this hot bread should never appear on the table. The rule does not, however, apply to unleavened bread. If it's unleavened, it can be hot, you see. Fresh rolls made of wheaten meal without yeast or leaven, those are qualifications, and baked in a well-heated oven are both wholesome and palatable. Without yeast or leaven. Don't make a mistake, will you? Read every word. Then that's good. See, that's hot. Now, talks about cereals for breakfast, apparently, in the next paragraph. Grains used for porridge or mush should have several hours cooking. That's not this instant stuff. And by the way, If you'll take the non-instant and use it instead of the instant, you'll find out that suddenly your morning cereal tastes about 10 times as good as it used to taste. It really does. There's a tremendous difference between whole grain, not instant, breakfast foods than there is an instant. Much, much difference. To me, there is. But she says, soft or liquid foods are less wholesome than dry foods, which require thorough mastication. There's something beneficial about dry foods over these soft or liquid foods. Zweibach, or twice-baked bread, as she calls it, is one of the most easily digested and most palatable foods. Let ordinary raised bread be cut in slices and dried in a warm oven until the last trace of moisture disappears. Then let it be browned slightly all the way through. In a dry place, this bread can be kept much longer than ordinary bread, and if reheated before using, it'll be as fresh as when new. Now, she said there's something beneficial about that, and that's whole wheat, Zweibach, is it not? The next thing she talks about, just little tidbits all along, far too much sugar is ordinarily used in food. Cakes, sweet puddings, pastries, jellies, jams are active cause of indigestion. I defy you this Sabbath to work an experiment. After you've sat here for 3 hours or some other place, Sabbath school in church, and you go home to eat, eat a normal meal but not too heavy, and eat no desserts, none. Not a one. And check to see indigestion. I don't care what age you are. Then the next Sabbath, do the same thing, eat a normal meal, and eat a nice big dessert. And check for indigestion afterward. And see what you'll discover about yourself. You'll be amazed. It's just that simple. The sugars seem to cause something in the stomach when you eat desserts that'll not be there when you leave it out. And it's very easy. You don't have to be old to find out that it's true. She said, especially harmful are the custards and puddings in which milk, eggs, and sugar are the chief ingredients, that combination. The free use of milk and sugar taken together should be avoided. So that's especially dangerous, it seems, when you put the two together. The sugar alone is not quite as bad as the sugar with the milk. Now, then she talks about dairy products. Mentions that milk should be sterilized. By the way, pasteurization is not sterilization, is it? Pasteurization is bringing it up to a certain temperature, then in a certain length of time, chilling it down to a lower temperature. And there are different methods of pasteurization. But she said it should be sterilized. If you talk to those who worked in county health departments where they checked dairies, you'll learn why she said that. If you're frightened to talk to them, keep on doing what you're doing. She said it should be sterilized. With this precaution, there's less danger of contracting disease from its use. Butter is less harmful when eaten on cold bread than when used in cooking. So if you must use butter, use it cold, not in cooking. But as a rule, it is better to dispense with it altogether. Cheese is still more objectionable. It is wholly unfit for food. And be careful about interpretations of the spirit process by non-prophets, even relatives of prophets. There's a reason why God put this down here, and I don't know all the reasons. But she seems to have an order, a sequence. Milk, then the butter is worse, and then cheese is still worse. And those who study cheeses can tell you very much about it. Our research is inadequate at the present time, I'm sure, to completely establish this statement. And there are many questions about where cheese is one of the main staples in diet, and I'm not trying to be difficult for them at all. But apparently God knows what he's talking about and permits the statement to be as strong as that. It's wholly unfit for food. That's a violently strong statement. Seldom does the spirit of prophecy talk like that or the Bible. The next thing is, scantily ill-cooked food depraves the blood by weakening the blood-making organs. Poorly cooked food, scanty, weakens the body and the blood-making organs. And some people just are so hasty about their cooking, you know, it's like that. It deranges the system, brings on disease, with irritable nerves and bad tempers. The victims of poor cookery are numbered by thousands and tens of thousands. Over many graves might be written, died because of poor cooking, died of an abused stomach. Isn't that something? And yet we don't think that cooking is very important nowadays. And almost every woman is taught to believe, a girl, that, you know, just to be a housewife is a terrible, poor job, right? You've accomplished nothing, be a mother and a housewife. And just think you can be a murderer by being something else, right? That's right. You can become a murderer by being a good office secretary, a good nurse, or a good teacher, whatever it might be, you see. And never realizing that lack of information that's, you know, looked down upon by society nowadays, cause us to do that to our families. Many souls are lost as a result of poor cookery. It takes thought and care to make good bread, but there's more religion in a loaf of good bread than many think. More religion, that's religion, friends. And we must stop to understand some of these concepts that have now become antiquated. Then she goes on and has a lot to say about cooking on page 302 and 303. That's very, very important. Now, these things, if we just take some time, if God is speaking, it's valuable. If it's only a person, you know, it's meaningless. But it's time we have testimonies week after week saying, I tried this, you know. It does something for me. It's time you're doing it routinely around your family and around your place where you work or where you go to school. Just say, hey, you know, I read this in Ministry of Healing. I tried it. You ought to try it. That's what I call a living witness. Then people say, well, if it works for you, maybe it worked for me. The next whole section is on regularity in eating. And this is something that we have great difficulty. Now, by regularity, she means something different than most people mean. Listen to what she says. It's of vital importance. There should be a specified time for each meal. Specified time for each meal. So it isn't just general, you know, the lunch hour. A specified time, she said. At this time, let everyone eat what the system requires, and then take nothing more until the next meal. Can you make it more specific? Eat at that time what the system requires and eat nothing more until the next meal. Let everyone do that. A specified regular time, just like clockwork. There are many who eat when the system needs no food at irregular intervals and between meals because they have not sufficient strength of will to resist inclination. When traveling, some are constantly nibbling if anything is eatable is within their reach. This is very injurious. If travelers would eat regularly a food that is simple and nutritious, they would not feel so great weariness nor suffer so much from sickness. Now, in our society, you know, where we wait until we find time to eat, right? Or we wait until the whole family arrives or something like that. Then we say, well, at last we can eat. And tonight is 5 o'clock and tomorrow is 7 o'clock. Or, you know, just such a variety. That's not regularity in eating. Humans are something like cows, you know. They want to be milked on the hour at a certain time. Every day, humans wanted to eat on time. I can recall when I first went into the military where we ate at a certain hour every meal a day and went to bed at a certain hour and would arise at a certain hour. You can't believe what happens to you. Just suddenly, you're a different person. And it isn't because the army's like that. You feel terrible because you're in the army, but you feel better because of the regularity. It just accomplishes things like that for you. You hate the schedules. We all used to gripe about them, but they did marvels for us. Just immediately, we were very young at that time in my life. And so these are very important things. She talks about eating before bedtime at the bottom of page 303. I won't ask how many do that. It'd be embarrassing. She tells why people do it. They think it's impossible to sleep without food. So this is very injurious. Why? The digestive process is continued through the sleeping hours. Your muscles in your arms and legs are relaxing. Your mind is relaxing. But all the digestive organs are working like a big cement mixer, aren't they? Just going on and on and on. It says, so the stomach works constantly, its work is not properly accomplished. It's only doing part of the job. The sleep is often disturbed with unpleasant dreams. In the morning, the person awakes unrefreshed, with little relish for breakfast. When we lie down to rest, the stomach should have its work all done, that is, as well as the other organs of the body may enjoy rest. For persons of sedentary habits, late suppers are particularly harmful. With them, the disturbance created is often the beginning of a disease that ends in death. So if you're just spending most of your time sitting down, never eat before bedtime. She goes on and tells how it ought to be something like 5 or 6 hours between meals. 5 or 6 hours. And science establishes that very nicely. Said for most, 2 meals a day would be adequate. She doesn't say for everyone, but for most, it'd be adequate. And that would give the length of time of 5 or 6 hours between meals. Now, these things are not God picking on us. Is that right? He's not picking on us. He's saying you've lost something. The sin has deprived us. Sin has robbed us. The devil's come down to destroy. And when he brought sin into the garden, he tried to disrupt that very healthful, joyful life that God intended us to have. He tried to disrupt these minds of ours. And read in this week's Sabbath School lesson how he attacks especially the intelligence. Because with these minds, you know, we learn to know God, do we not? With these minds we grasp. With these minds we choose. With these minds we comprehend. With these minds we keep from deception. If the devil can only do something to your mind to make it a weak instrument, you know, we're just wholly his slaves. We don't have to be devil-possessed to be lost. We just have to have weakened brains. And by our diets, he's attacking our intellects. He really is. Time after time. We could work a nice experiment in this church and show you how. Have everyone go on a fast on Wednesday morning and eat nothing Wednesday and then come to prayer meeting Wednesday night. We'll get a photographer up here with a nice motion picture camera, you know, and take pictures of all of you on Wednesday night. And then we'll take an examination on the presentation that night. And the next week we'll let you eat the normal way you eat normally on Wednesdays and come and take pictures of you then and give an examination, see what happens. You'd be amazed. We go away and forget almost everything we hear from classrooms, from lectures, from sermons, from devotions, from worship, don't we? You know why? The way we eat. The way we eat. Much of our mental lethargy is caused by improper eating. The devil's come down to destroy us mentally. And he knows he can get at the mind through our stomachs. We don't believe it. He's known it for centuries, for millenniums. And so he attacks us. He gets us so busy we don't have time to eat. He makes us irregular. Then we just gulp our food and we don't enjoy it and it doesn't nourish us. Then we eat the wrong things. Nothing else is, takes a little more time to prepare, you see. He keeps all the mothers working, all the cooks. Right? So they have very little time to prepare food. So when you finally sit down, everybody sits down and eats, you know, like a horse race. Isn't that right? Who can finish first? Some sit down and watch the TV. Very exciting news, maybe, or something like that. And the mind is not at peace or at rest. Some sit down at the table and quarrel all the time. Don't they? All sorts of things we do, you know, that prevent us from enjoying one of the most important things of life. Eating to live. Eating to be healthy. Eating for strength and not for drunkenness. God has not blessed the Adventist church with diet. He's not cursed us with diet. He's blessed us, hasn't he? He's meant it for a great blessing, enormous blessing. May we somehow throw away all those ideas he's given us, a bunch of no-nos. That he was trying to confine us and give us medication 3 times a day. He was trying to help us to discover the tremendous blessings he put when he said, you may eat of every tree of the garden freely. What did he mean by all that? And it was good for food. And you can have all, you know. It's good for food. A great variety, a great blessing. God is so interested that you, in your health. I come that you might have life and have it more abundantly, Jesus said. And he sent down this light to be the life of men. May God help us to grasp that the Lord is for us when it comes to diet. And he's asking, why will you die when I want you to live, you know? Why will you suffer in mind and body and strength? Why don't you live and be vigorous? Vigorous in muscle, vigorous in intellect, vigorous in all healthful ways, so that you can truly enjoy the life that God is giving us here and planned for us over yonder. May God help us to grasp this. Next week we'll start right where we left off and go on diet and health. Shall we stand for prayer? Loving Father in heaven, thou art the giver of every good and precious gift. As the Lord planned for man's diet to keep him alive and healthy and strong and to live endlessly, he planned for good, life-giving food. Some of that food is still here, and we're so grateful for savory food that the Lord grows in abundance all about us. And especially in this land in which we live, there's so much of so many good things. Make us selective. Make us wise. Make us choosy in that which we eat. Take into consideration what we want our bodies to be like and to become because they're what we eat. And grant us that we'll find out that mealtime is one of the happiest times of the day when our loving Heavenly Father has provided in advance for all our needs. And there in abundance the food is set out before us. May we enjoy not only what He gives us, but sweet fellowship with heaven and with one another. And grant, Lord, that day by day as we follow these marvelous guidelines, we'll have life and have it more abundantly, that our whole lives will be a testimony to the goodness of the Lord to us. Lord, keep us and bless us and grant us good health. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.